This week, we are rebroadcasting a very special episode from January, an interview with Minjin Lee, award-winning author of the novel Pachinko. There has been discussions recently of turning the book into a TV series, so if you haven't read the book yet, you should grab a copy today. I wanted to also share that we are going to release a very special episode about finding your roots and family history next Wednesday, just in time for your travels for Thanksgiving. So look out for Korean Context next week on Wednesday. With that, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., this is Korean Context, and here is Jenna Gibson's interview with Minjin Lee, author of Pachinko.
For this week's episode, I am really honored that I was able to speak with author Minjin Lee. She is the author of a recently released novel called Pachinko that topped the bestseller list last year, is continuing to sell very well, and was one of the best books of the year, according to many outlets, including NPR, New York Times, and more. So it's a really wonderful novel. The story takes place from the early 1900s up until the 1980s, following a Korean family and their trials and tribulations as they moved to Japan, immigrated to Japan, and go through issues including discrimination, including poverty, and all kinds of really powerful themes. And I'm really grateful that Minjin was able to take the time to talk with me both about Pachinko and its success, but also about the story that she was trying to tell and how she came across that story and decided to tell it in the way that she did. So please enjoy this conversation. So first of all, Minjin, I want to thank you so much for your time, for talking to me here about your novel, Pachinko. To get the conversation started, to start from the beginning, I guess, what motivated you to write Pachinko, a novel that mainly follows a Korean family in Japan? How did you become inspired to tell the stories of Koreans living in Japan?
Well, I was 19 years old and I was in college, and I went to a lecture given by an American missionary who worked with the Koreans in Japan, and I learned about the history of the Koreans in Japan at that moment in time. I didn't know anything about it, really. I had a vague idea about the occupation, but I didn't know what it was like for the people there. And then I heard a story that was quite disturbing to me, where he talked about a 13-year-old boy in his parish who jumped off a building and then he killed himself because he was just terribly bullied. And in the yearbook, which his parents had found, his Japanese classmates had written, "Go back to where you belong. I hate you," and they wrote these words, "die, die, die." And this little boy was, of course, ethnically Korean, but he was born in Japan. His parents were born in Japan. And it was very hard for me to understand that this could exist. Later on, I never forgot the story. It sort of affected me. I wanted to know more about it. I still continued to major in history, and I went to law school, and I practiced law for 2 years. And after I quit, I thought I would write a book about the Koreans in Japan. And I ended up writing one between 1996 to 2003. However, it wasn't a very good novel. It wasn't a very good history book. It was really kind of like a practice book. So I never sent that to publication because my first book had been rejected everywhere, and I just couldn't really handle the idea of getting rejected twice. So I decided to put that aside, and I ended up writing Free Food for Millionaires. But I think what really motivated me really was that moment in time when I was at university and I heard that story, because I couldn't understand how children could be so hateful. Because, I mean, I know children can be mean, but I couldn't imagine a kind of rejection based on ethnicity, because I had been an American immigrant and I had not been treated that way when I was growing up in Queens.
Wow, yeah, that's such a powerful and horrible story. I can't even imagine how that would affect you. I mean, even just hearing the story, much less going through something like that.
Yeah, and I didn't end up writing about the bullying. That's not what the book is about at all. But something about that moment in time, it just filled me with this kind of indignation. And when I was in college, I think I felt like the whole world was so unfair anyway, probably my hormones. And then later on, when I got older, I started really thinking about what does that mean and how does that affect all of us? And, you know, I didn't experience the war myself. I didn't experience the occupation myself. So why should it affect me? But something about this idea of trauma that had affected my parents, and somehow I believe very strongly that next generation carries a kind of trauma unconsciously just from just sheer exposure. So I wanted to explore it. I had a lot of questions. And then I ended up writing the book again when I moved to Japan between 2007 and 2011.
So that actually leads really well into my next question, because the story in Pachinko spans many decades and even several generations. And in many ways, this story could kind of go on forever if you wanted it to, you know, following along with this family. So I'm wondering how you decided, you know, this is the moment in time when I'm going to begin, and okay, this is when it's time to stop.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Jenna. So what ended up happening was the book that I had written from 1996 to 2003 really focused on the last generation, Solomon, which people have a hard time understanding. But that's really who I was focused on, because I thought it was going to be a very short book. I thought maybe 350 printed pages, which is about 450 manuscript pages. And it was going to be based on a Wall Street trading scandal. And my cast would be multiracial, mostly set in Tokyo, focusing on this sort of one young man, Solomon, who was ethnically Korean. And that was my big idea. But of course, the book didn't work at all. And then when I went there and I interviewed all these Korean Japanese people, I realized that my character Solomon makes no sense at all without understanding his father, Moses, without understanding his mother, Tanja, and without understanding how she got to Japan. Because there's so much that we don't know about this community that I had to explain it really in four generations, almost five, because the history of Korea and the history of Japan are so interconnected in the 20th century that I had to explain it, but I wasn't going to write a history book. I wrote a novel, so I focused on one family. But to answer your question, why did I stop in 1989? I stopped in 1989 almost like as a point of amusement for myself, because that's when I learned about the story.
Oh, okay. I like that a lot, actually. That little, it makes a lot of sense. And actually, you are once again perfectly leading into my next question here, because I wanted to ask you about the fact that while you talk about all these various characters, their different struggles, you centered a lot of the story around Sanja and her experiences as a young woman, as a mother, as the pillar of her family. So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about Sanja as a character and how you wove in some of these themes that a lot of female readers, myself included, can really identify with?
I think that what's really troubling to me is that Sanja is a character in a moment in time who is illiterate, who is poor, who has no connections, who has no legal protections from the society in which she lives in. And you would think that a person like that doesn't exist anymore. But the truth is that most women around the world actually have Sanja's experience today. And because women of color and because women around the world pretty much still live in a patriarchal structure, women have to figure out how they will adapt and resist and take care of themselves as well as their families if they have families. And I was so surprised at the resonance that this book is having around the world, because I was consciously thinking of it as a feminist, as a global feminist. At the same time, I was also thinking about it in terms of narration of like, what do you do when all these things are happening, but you don't have any input on the decisions that you make in your life, except what you could do on a very, very, very small scale. So, you know, what's happening in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or in the African nations, as well as the Americas, and in many European countries, even today, women still have to negotiate what happens because they have a uterus. And I found that to be really quite striking. And Tanja's acts of resistance, Tanja's acts of adaptation are not theoretical, and they're certainly not explicit theoretically. She wouldn't say, oh, I'm a feminist and I believe in these things. I think her attitude is, what fire do I have to put out today? And I really wanted to focus on that in a very pragmatic sense, but I also wanted to write a novel that was interesting and a joy to read. I wanted the person who's reading it, my reader, whether she's a feminist or not, to feel like, oh, this is what my grandmother went through in America, or what my mother goes through right now, because even today, there are so many people in this country who are illiterate, who have so few protections, and yet they still have to put out the fires that present themselves.
Yeah, I definitely felt that as a reader when I was reading Pachinko. I mean, I told you when I reached out to you for this interview that I completely devoured this novel, and I was not kidding about that. And it's because of that human resonance, in a lot of cases with Sunja and her struggles, but all these characters, they're so human, they're very complex. And I think when you're reading this novel, anyone can find a character or a particular struggle that they can identify with in this family. So I really congratulate you on really great writing and great storytelling in that way.
Oh, golly, thank you so much. And, you know, it's funny because, I mean, obviously, you know a lot about Korean history and the Korean economy. But one of the things that I think a lot of Korean Americans and people who study Korea don't like to mention, because it may seem like it's an embarrassing fact, but it's just a historical reality, is that the level of illiteracy for women in Korea was so high, and that was intentional, and that was something that happened across class lines, because you could have been a ruling class Korean woman, and yet you were not encouraged to read the Yi dynasty. In fact, many ruling class families prohibited women from reading, and of course, the vast majority of the agrarian culture of women were not allowed to read. And yet their history is entirely absent, primarily because in order to have a history, you have to have documents. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about that novel, and I wanted to raise it as a point of discussion, because sometimes people think that Koreans are the Koreans post-1975. And it's sort of silly, because that isn't true. And then I also wanted to talk about the role of Christianity and how it affects Koreans. History, because whether you like it or not, it's an important part of Korean history in the 20th and 21st century.
Yeah, so you're talking about some of these social issues that kind of underpin a lot of what's going on in Pachinko. And here on Korean Context, of course, I'm here in Washington, D.C. We talk about politics, we talk about policy, social issues all the time. So I have to ask you, I noticed that a lot of these themes that you weave in, themes of the Korean occupation, colonial times, the war, the division of the peninsula. I know, for example, some of the characters struggled with these groups in Japan that were affiliated with either the North or the South, and deciding, you know, should I go back to the peninsula, which side to go back to. So I'm wondering, how and why did you decide to weave some of these broader, deeper political and historical issues into the story of this family?
I think that I made a conscious decision that I would just take it all on. And that was completely insane, because it ended up taking up most of my life. I'm 49 years old, and this book took up a good part of my life, because I needed to understand that not just historically, anthropologically, sociologically, economically, as well as religion and philosophy and sociology, because I actually read all those things about the Korean Japanese. If there was a scholar out there writing about it, I was reading it. And then after I read it, I thought, okay, well, that's fine. But then I needed to write it as a novel. So I was focusing a great deal on how do I make this into a 19th century novel, but in clear American English prose. So like I had these sort of tasks that I set up for myself, because the reason why all those things have to occur every time you write about Koreans, every single time, and this is like a huge task if you set up for yourself, is because every Korean in the world is affected by the division of the peninsula. Whether or not like your entire family's in Busan, it affects you, because your compatriot lives in a bisected geographical nation. And that bisection was not because of democracy. That line was drawn by two young American men who had never been to Korea. And that occurred, and that history is not represented. So many people are affected by these choices that had nothing to do with Koreans. And it's fascinating. And I wanted people to make this discussion more relevant and for it to keep going on, because, and it's not about blame or anything like that at all, but if you really want to feel powerful about your life, you have to understand how your life came to be and how do we prevent this from going on in the future. So I have family from both North and the South, but essentially what I'm really saying is I have family from Korea, because this idea of a division and having a bisected nation is only a 70-year-old concept, really. So how do we make sense of a 5,000-year-old civilization and a 70-year-old idea of two republics? So all this affects character, because all these people who are alive today who remember one peninsula. And so I tried really hard to put that all into these characters. And I'm really glad I did personally, because I'm done. I'm really glad I understand these things. But I don't think I had any idea how hard it would be for me and how much time it would take. But I'm glad I did it. But it was really, in some ways, I think it was really foolish, because it took so much time. And I really didn't know that it would take this much time.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how much reading that would be.
I think it was just bananas. And then also the interviews that I did, which illustrated for me that every one of the scholars have been working so rigorously toward was so relevant in every Korean person that I met around the world. And it's not just a Korean-American person. Like, I meet a person from Brazil who's ethnically Korean. And he or she may have no consciousness of the history, because it's not taught in an active way in any of the curricula around the world. So you'd have to go seek it out yourself. But there are scholars out there who are working very diligently to try to explain these things. And their books are unread, primarily because they're very serious works of scholars, and it's very academic, and they're written for peer review. So it's not accessible to the average person. So the thing that I get consistently is I get letters from people around the world now saying, oh, I didn't know this about my history. And they're really pleased with having read this, and then they share their book. But I wasn't thinking of it in that way. I was just thinking, like, I want to know more too, and I'd like to write this story. And once people told me things in an interview, and I wonder if you feel this, is that I did feel a sense of responsibility, like, oh, what do I do with this? Because someone gave me their time and their gifts, and someone, like, a person was vulnerable with me. Like, very often I've had these interviews and people are very vulnerable with me about what, you know, what their sister went through, or their cousin went through, or their mother. And I felt like, okay, well, I have to protect this. And at the same time, I have to share it, because this person does want me to share it.
Okay, so Pachinko has been getting a lot of praise, appearing on multiple lists as one of the best books of 2017. So I'm curious, how do you feel knowing that so many people loved your work? And do you have any particular stories or moments that stood out to you as more and more people have been responding to your book?
I'm totally in shock. I'm totally in shock, and I'm so grateful. It hit the top 10 for USA Today, the New York Times. It hit the reviews. It hit the list of Financial Times and probably 30 other publications. And it's a shock, because when I wrote this book, and because I worked on it for such a long time, I felt like nobody cares. I don't even know why I'm doing this. I kind of have ruined my life, because I quit being a lawyer, and at one point I didn't have health insurance. And I had to pay for it privately, because my husband, like, we had all these issues. And, like, I was like, oh, my God, this is crazy. I can't believe I'm doing this. And I also had experienced a really serious illness while I was working on it. But I did know for a fact that this is the first novel written in English about the Korean Japanese in the world. I knew that because I had done all the scholarship. I had done all the reading to see what's out there. So there are lots and lots of academic texts which are so wonderful, and they're listed in the back of my acknowledgement. So without those books, I really couldn't have written this book, not just based on interviews, because I had to know the facts. But after I wrote it, I figured, who cares about 600,000 people in the 21st century in the world? This is a micro ethnicity, micro community. Why should I do this? And then I remember handing it to my agent, and I just figured, okay, well, if she can't sell it, then I'm just going to, you know, move on and work on the next thing, or try to, like, sell shoes or whatever. And I'm not being comical, like, there, because I quit being a lawyer and I stopped like keeping up with my CLE requirements. It wasn't like I can just go back and pick up and be an attorney again. And I had left the bar. So I really didn't know what I could do. And also I'm 49 and it's not easy to get hired when you're 49. So in terms of surprise stories, all these lists are surprises. And also, you know, I had the ambassador, Caroline Kennedy, wrote to me unsolicited because she read the book. I was really surprised.
That's amazing.
Like the first minister of Scotland read the book and she tweeted about it. You know, Roxane Gay picked it for her favorite book in the Washington Post. John Boyne, who's a really important writer in Ireland, is his favorite book. Like, there are all these things that you just don't, you're thinking, why would they care? And then you realize, like, oh, they enjoyed the reading and they enjoyed the learning. And I think for me, that's always been so important, is that it can't just be like a page turner. Like, just writing a page turner is really difficult. And I spent my life learning how to write something that's really plotted, because my wheelhouse is a 19th century novel, which was always serialized. So that's something that I know how to do. But then to put content in there where a person feels like, oh, I walked away and it wasn't a waste of my time. In fact, I know I'm much stronger about something. So my first book is about class and materialism and how Korean Americans are dealing with aspiration in this country. And I wanted to write about money and what money means to immigrants. That's my first book. And then my second book is really about what did Koreans do in Japan for 100 years and what are they doing today? And that's really important to me, like, because I wanted to know more about it. So I wrote these books. But I got to tell you, the whole response, it's lovely. It's such a lovely thing. It hit number one yesterday in the in Boston Globe for paperback on the bestseller list. And I was like, no way. That's amazing.
So congratulations.
I'm kind of in shock. Thank you. No, I'm in shock. So it's great. But at the same time, you kind of can't take it all that seriously because, you know, like, you'll just become a jerk. So I think the thing is to be grateful and to kind of like go, okay, just go to the next thing and just be grateful.
All right. So I want to start wrapping up here and give you the chance if you have anything else that you want to say. But then also, if you have any upcoming projects that you can share with us, things that we can be looking forward to, if you could share that with us as well.
Yeah, my next work is part of a trilogy, because Free Food for Millionaires is about Koreans in America. And my second book, Pachinko, is about the Koreans in Japan. And my third book, called American Hagwon, and of course, this audience knows what Hagwon is, a Korean school for students. I'm writing about Hagwons around the world. So I'm focusing on the role of education and how important it is for Koreans around the world. So I'll be focusing on writing a novel about this project, and I've already started, and I've started interviewing people, and I started going to site locations. And it'll be based in different cities. Like, so you'll have Sydney and London and New York and different cities in America where Hagwons are very prevalent, because wherever Koreans go in the diaspora, they bring Hagwons with them.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. I will definitely be anticipating that upcoming book from you. So this has been Minjin Lee, the author of the wonderful book Pachinko. I highly recommend it. I really want to thank you not only for writing such a lovely book, but also for taking the time and talking to me about it here today.
No, thank you, Jenna. I really appreciate your kind support.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Minjin Lee, and you should pick up a copy of Pachinko next time you're passing by a bookstore if you haven't already. Just a quick reminder that we'll be releasing our next episode on Wednesday instead of Friday. And as always, if you have any questions, tweet at us at KoreaEconInst. Also, remember to tune in every Monday at 2 p.m. for our Facebook Live program, Korea This Week, where KAI covers all the major developments on the Korean Peninsula. See you there!